like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal at this point. In this appeal, we are asking the court to find a single, unambiguous meaning in a decree of dissolution that could have been written a whole lot better than it actually was. And
the decree or the property settlement agreement or both?
Both. Because the decree incorporates the property settlement agreement, so as a matter of law, they're one document. So they have provisions that say different things. Only as an alternative to that, if the court declines to find our single unambiguous meaning, which is favorable to Mr. Carlson, are we asking the court to give us our day in court to allow a request to modify that provision to be heard on the merits? And then lastly, we're asking the court to award the district, to reverse the district court's fee award. Now, both sides in this appeal agree that the interpretation of an unambiguous document, whether that's a judgment or a contract or anything else, is a question of law, which means two important things. The first is that extrinsic or parole evidence is completely irrelevant and should not be considered by the district court if the document is unambiguous. And second, it means this court's standard of review is de novo, meaning this court makes up its own mind in terms of what the document is. Now, put a little bit more brutally, what this means, and this is alluded to in Strunk versus Cromie Strunk, is that this court does not interpret the decree that the parties say they wanted. This court interprets the decree that the parties actually signed. And that's a good thing here because, frankly, nobody can explain the connection between both parties' testimony about what their intentions were and what their discussions were with the mediator and the language that ended up in this document. There's just a complete disconnect.
Is there an ambiguity between the way that the property settlement agreement defines emancipation and the way the term emancipation is used in the decree language itself?
I do not believe there is. For drafting, certainly. Ambiguity, no. And the reason is a document is ambiguous if it's susceptible to two separate but conflicting reasonable interpretations.
Well, how is emancipation defined in the property settlement agreement?
In the property settlement
agreement. Poorly or not.
In the property settlement agreement, emancipation occurs after a child commits either by the child's actions or by a non-exhaustive list of circumstances, including marriage, entering military service, become self-supporting, and dying,
whichever is
occurs
later.
Last.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So, and in fact, we joked with the trial court that the Carlson children may one day find themselves unemancipated senior citizens.
At the age of 98.
Correct. Correct. After both their parents are dead. And that if you just view that emancipation provision in a vacuum, you could have Mark's estate paying support to Karen's estate, who's doing goodness knows what.
So how is emancipation, that term, used in the decree language itself?
In the decree, the decree does not attempt to redefine emancipation. The decree contains what the district court refers to as standard language.
Do you agree it's standard language?
Well, so after we wrote our briefs, we found the statute that everybody, I think, kind of knew was there, but nobody actually pays attention to. It's somewhere in Chapter 42 that says that by default, child support terminates upon these statutory factors. But this is one of those.
And it sort of tracks with those statutory factors, doesn't
it?
Yeah.
It does. So, but we contend that this decree and the property settlement agreement can have a single unambiguous meaning, and that is that mandatory support terminates per statute upon the earliest of those factors kicking in, and that discretionary support may continue after that, subject to being worked out by the parties. And the decree has all sorts of provisions in it about further mediation and that they should negotiate the balance of payments and what if the kids
does
are
it have any provision for modification of the post-minority child support?
Explicitly no. And I have a big problem with a legal decision that says that you can sign one of these things and there's absolutely no disclosure of any sort that what you're signing is not modifiable ever. I mean, you know, in our brief, we analogize
with
this to
fraud and gross inequity. Doesn't the statute allow property settlement agreements to be modified under those circumstances?
Certainly. But Your Honor, this is not, the provisions that we're arguing about here is not the distribution of property. Look, it doesn't say who gets the blender or the retirement account.
Don't property settlement agreements include the support of spouses and children under the statute?
They do. They do. The statute is broadly worded. I think they can even include custody under that umbrella of a property settlement agreement. But from a policy standpoint, we have to draw a distinction between, so family law is just this constant battle, and I'm not talking about between husband and wife or mother and father. It's this constant battle between the need to have finality in litigation, res judicata, and the need to have flexibility to deal with unforeseen material changes and circumstances. I mean, we have to, not only is it provided for by statute, but we have to allow custody and support to get modified because people have ups and downs economically, and then people have ups and downs personally that can render them to be unfit parents. So to ask, to say that this post-majority provision, because it doesn't deal with minor children, therefore it must be property, therefore it must be modifiable only under this very high standard of fraud or gross inequity, it's not good policy and it just doesn't make any sense. So getting back to the mortgages. So when you apply for a mortgage, you have to sign a stack of documents this tall. And half of the documents are what are the fees you're going to pay, the fact that they can take your house away, the fact that you really, really, really have to pay this. And we treat people that apply for mortgages and don't pay them better than Karen Carlson is asking this court to treat us, where there was no disclosure, no discussion about it, and it just ended up in this document that just went on and on and on. So I would be remiss if I didn't thank the court for taking this case and hope that this court has accepted our challenge that we thought we were making to the Court of Appeals. Put this language in, we asked the Court of Appeals for 5 or 6 people, I'll ask this court to do 14 or 15 different people's hands. Have them read it twice a day for a week. Bring them all back together, and I am convinced that a consensus will develop that agrees with us, that the post-majority support is discretionary because the decree says, or I'm sorry, the property settlement agreement says that support may continue if the children are in college. And it says it actually in two places, in the preparatory language and in the language that talks about them being in college. And more to the point, Karen's counsel agrees with us in their brief on page 19, line 5, that our interpretation is reasonable. So remember, to have an ambiguous document, you have to have two separate but reasonable interpretations. So their admission puts us inches from the finish line. In order to find that this document is ambiguous, you have to find that their contrary interpretation of the same language is also reasonable, and I just don't think you can do that. To find that contrary interpretation is reasonable puts it completely at odds with the language's plain meaning. May never creates an obligation. It simply can't. And we give you a lovely string cite in our brief that says that. We cite to, I can't find it in my notes, it's somewhere in chapter 49, 49-802 is the legislature's own rules about how it writes statutes. And it's just common sense. This is something that we learn on like the third day of contracts class in law school. If you want to create an obligation, you include words like shall or will or something mandatory. And if you want to make something discretionary, you include the word may. So certainly there's bad drafting here, but remember, bad drafting does not mean that the contract or the document is ambiguous. Ambiguity only occurs if there's two separate reasonable meanings. They concede ours is reasonable. We do not concede that theirs is reasonable. So I think you have to find it's unambiguous. I think you have to find that the district court improperly interpreted it, and I think that this is a very short path to a full reversal on remand.
Let me just ask you one small question. You were referring to 4982?
802,
you're right. 802, I beg your pardon. Right, right. And that's like how words are used in statutes, essentially?
Correct. Okay. The legislature's rules for itself in terms of how it should
how it uses statutes. Words in statutes and so forth. So if it's a word of art or a phrase of art, that's what they mean to use.
Correct.
Okay. Is this... How does this work with the word may?
Well, that statute, 49802, says that the legislature should use may when it intends something to be discretionary
Thank
or
you.
Optional, and it should use shall if it intends to mean
Thank
an
you.
Obligation.
And
again,
of course,
it doesn't apply to decrees, but it's the
you,
best we can.
You would concede there are cases for the mandatory may or the discretionary shall.
I'm only aware of cases for the mandatory may, and I would generally lump those into some sort of due process type of case, which is a different animal than we have here.
Okay.
All right, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Belmont, good morning to you.
In the decree and the property settlement on when child support terminated. had a trial on it. The decree contained the standard provisions for terminating child support. Age majority, emancipation, become self-supporting. The property settlement agreement was sealed, defined certain terms that conflicted with the actual decree. It defined the term age majority. It could be 19, but unless the parties otherwise agree. It defined the term emancipation, and then it goes on to have a specific provision for support past age 19. And it's, again, it starts qualifying that provision. So the court was correct when you read the document that you can have two, it is susceptible to at least two reasonable but conflicting interpretations or meanings in the document. The second, and that's one, the second ambiguity the court found is that in paragraph 3.014A, the child will not be deemed to be emancipated, and child support may continue. And that sets forth some circumstances, one of which was college. The appellant is saying that's discretionary. Well, his client never said that was discretionary when I tried to get him, or when I was cross-examining him. If it was discretionary, it would defeat the purpose of that entire provision of paying support past 19. The reasonable interpretation when you read that document, which the trial court found, was when it refers to May, it refers to if the child's going to college. If the child's not going to college, he does not have to pay support past the age 19.
Counsel, can you tell me procedurally how we got to the declaratory judgment phase in this dissolution action?
Procedurally, there was a modification back in 2010, and that's in the record. And we had a decrease in the alimony, the increase in the child support at that time. I reserved the rights regarding the termination provisions in the property settlement agreement. They were going to stay in full force and effect. The appellant had asked during that proceeding to try to terminate the child support at age 19 and withdrew their request. Subsequently, when the child turns age 19, we don't get child support. And the child support payment center is not going to do anything because it's a sealed decree. So at that point in time, I cited the appellant in for contempt. We had a contempt proceeding. Both counsel and I decided, it may not be contempt and then we may need to get clarification because of an ambiguity in the document. So we filed a declaratory judgment at that time.
In the dissolution action. And both parties are asking for a declaratory judgment with respect to the meaning of the decree.
Correct.
Do you think there is any other adequately serviceable remedy in the terms of the jurisprudence?
Well, this Newjar versus Newjar, and it's not cited here, says that...
And I'm not disputing whether you can do a declaratory judgment or ask for it. I'm saying is it the most serviceable, or is there another serviceable remedy on your facts? Was there any other way to resolve this?
No, I don't think so. We get cited, the contempt citation is one element. And when you can't ask the court to... based on the Newjar case, go interpret your decree. That's not a viable remedy. Your court said specifically, there's other remedies, declaratory judgment, contempt citation, or modification in that case. So from a procedural standpoint, I think this was the way to...
Why wouldn't the other remedies that you just mentioned work to get you where you needed to go in this case?
Well, if it's a contempt action, then we'd have to show that it was willful and wanton, that he's willfully, and the appellant could say, hey, listen, I read this thing differently, or make the same argument, well, they didn't make it, they could interpret it and say that I'm not obligated to pay child support, just like he's doing here, saying that the decree doesn't say that I have to pay child support, it says may, regardless of the fact that it may only to the extent of whether the children go to college. It's a is a decree where it was clear that once the court found the ambiguity, in Ryder versus Ryder, a case that recently was heard in 2015 or came down, said once an ambiguity is found, you need to deal with the intent of the parties. And you can't simply vacate a provision that you don't like in the decree or that isn't clear. So we had the declaratory judgment, and clearly I think the evidence showed that it was the intent of the parties that child support be paid until age 27 if the children are in college. That also is, if you look at the decree under the expenses for college, it refers to that there may be some overlapping between paying college expenses and also paying child support at the same time. And that needs to be adjusted or worked out between the parties.
Does this action resolve the legal issues in dispute?
I believe so. Sure.
So the district court says X, that means Mr. Carlson has to pay the child support.
As long as the conditions are present.
Which has not been done. Child support's not paid.
Not correct. Well,
so contempt action has to follow.
If child support was not being paid, contempt action would apply.
And if one of this list of things happens?
If, for instance, I'm sorry.
Oh, going to college.
Going to college. If the children no longer can make the grade and they're no longer in college, and they have specific provisions in there, they'd have two semesters to try to get back, I think, into college and before you terminate the college expense before you terminate the child support. It was an agreement that was reviewed by both parties. Both these parties are educated.
They were representing themselves in the divorce.
They were representing themselves, although the record does reflect that Mr. Carlson, the appellant in this case, did consult with an attorney, and it was stipulated it was a great attorney, if you read the record. Who Mr. Astley knows, he was prior to entering into mediation, so he had some background. Plus, they're both educated people who wanted to get divorced, and they wanted to do right with their children, and this is what was the outcome. And I think with the extrinsic evidence that was presented at trial, it's clear that it was the intent of the parties that that child support continue until age 27 if they're in college. Now, there's also I want to bring this up because there's some question in the Ryder case about whether once this is, do we use just contractual interpretations on a property settlement agreement, or once this thing is made part of a decree and entered into the court, it's now a judgment. And so this court in Ryder cited Rice versus Webb, and I believe Justice Castle wrote, we specifically disapproved of the application of contract principles to a property settlement agreement that had been included into a decree. Once a property settlement agreement has been incorporated into a decree of dissolution, the contractual character of the agreement is subsumed into the court-ordered judgment. At that point, the court and the parties are no longer dealing with a mere contract between the parties. Now we're dealing with an order of the court, and the order of the court would not give one party discretion on whether they want to pay child support or not. That doesn't make sense, at least to me. And the question to Mr. Astley about may and shall, not only is we think it's conditional, but it's permissive unless it defeats the whole purpose, and for the purpose of the legislative section, if it defeats the whole purpose of the statute. This, by using may and being permissive, would defeat the whole purpose. See, I'm out of time. I would respectfully request that the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 50 seconds, Mr. Astley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Members of the court, if you have any hesitation about a full reversal on this case, ask yourself the following questions. Who determines when Mark gets to stop paying these post-majority payments? Does he have to file another declaratory relief to have the court determine that the conditions in that paragraph have no longer been met, or is he allowed to stop paying on his own? Child Support Payment Center wants direction from the court, so we have to go through this onerous process of making the monthly payment every month, including a letter to the clerk of the district court and so forth, but I assure you he's making the payments. Who will force Karen Carlson to spend the child support that she receives for her adult children on the children? There's no mechanism in place to do that. There's no conservatorship over an adult child or anything like that. And who will decide what happens when the children stop and start or graduate from college and then take a semester off and then go back to graduate school as provided for in that paragraph? The answer is it must be flexible, which means it must be discretionary. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That takes us.